I was walking down the road to get my newspaper one morning, and I heard one guy yell to another that he was going to break the ashes, and I didn't know what that meant, but I asked my research associate when I got home, and he gave me this odd look, and he said, "That's just a little bit of insider humor from one drinker to another." Breaking the ashes refers to what housewives do when they get up in the morning. They kind of get the hearth going again. They break up the ashes from last night's fire, and they get the wood in for this morning's fire so they can brew up a cup of tea. But the ashes and the fire that the drinker is talking about is the warmth that they get from a shot of liquor.
Buddhism obviously is the main religion there, and there are prohibitions against the consumption of mind-altering substances, but the young men in the area are drinking more and more.
In Buddhism, at least in Theravada Buddhism as it's practiced in Sri Lanka, there are five precepts that are roughly equivalent to something like the Ten Commandments, maybe in Christianity. And the fifth precept is that people shouldn't take mind-altering substances. And if the role of Buddhist meditation or Buddhist practices is to be mindful, to be right thinking, Buddhists see mind-altering substances, liquor included, as an impediment in that path, as a way of distracting people from other, perhaps more worthwhile pursuits, and also as a way of maybe leading people astray. In the village, and in much of Sri Lanka, I think, the distribution of drinkers is very gendered. Women often don't drink at all, whereas men do drink, can drink, and sometimes must drink in particular social contexts. I think both men and women would consider themselves Buddhists, but when I ask why women don't drink, often Buddhism was raised as a reason, whereas when I ask why men do drink or don't drink, other issues are raised instead.
Did you notice a large underground economy for liquor?
Absolutely. And this is, I think, a place where ethnographic qualitative research can illuminate what's going on and make sense of some of the statistics that people read about alcohol use in Sri Lanka and elsewhere. Estimates vary about the percentage of liquor consumed in Sri Lanka that is licit and illicit, and those percentages vary up to 90% being illicit. In the village where I did my research, my informants suggested it was probably most of the liquor that was consumed was locally distilled and not manufactured and taxed in legal ways.
A large percentage of illicit liquor would certainly get the state's attention in the fact that they would want more revenue from taxes. And yet, if it's that large, the local police obviously must be aware of it, but there must be an interesting dynamic going on there if the percentages remain so high.
That's a very good question. In fact, I had an entire chapter written about, you know, allegations of corruption and the complicity between the police and local politicians and local manufacturers of illicit liquor. And for a variety of reasons, including ethical ones of not wanting to get anybody in trouble, that chapter didn't make it into the final book. I think there's an issue that we should underscore, which is that the reason illicit liquor is profitable is because it is cheaper, if only by a little, than licit liquor. And this legal liquor is taxed so much that it becomes almost unaffordable for working class people. What we have then is a sort of a distinction in social groups arising from who can afford what type of liquor, and then a criminalization of anybody who's poor, or most men who are poor, because they can get in trouble for drinking hooch. But at the same time, that's what everybody locally drinks. So there's kind of a duality going on here that everybody drinks it and yet it's illegal. And the local police, I think, understand that dynamic. And are they being compassionate, or are they being bribed, or are they being realistic? It's a hard call to make, and not one that I eventually, and my editor eventually, felt comfortable making in print. But I would say that the larger issues really are questions of health, right? And illicit distillate can be poisonous. Methyl alcohol is poisonous, and people can go blind and die if they drink it.
There is ceremonial drinking that takes place, and that certainly is condoned socially. How often does this take place? What sort of ceremonies? Is this a daily thing, monthly thing, or once in a while for holidays?
I think that people there drink as we do here in terms of, you know, if you're having a feast, if you're having a party, if somebody's getting married, if there's a retirement or a promotion to celebrate. I would say that drinking at that sort of ceremony is kind of episodic. Many of those ceremonies take place at auspicious times, and those auspicious times tend to cluster. There are also yearly moments to celebrate. Just as we have holidays, they have holidays. Similarly, while there are times when people might drink more, there are also times when people might drink less. So, for example, around the Vaisak full moon holiday in May, this is a holiday celebrated to commemorate the birth, the enlightenment, and the death of the Lord Buddha. That's a time when people really rein in their drinking.
Alcohol abuse is a problem pretty much around the world, certainly in the West. How do Sri Lankans approach this problem? And I understand there's some indigenous ways that they look at the problem.
I think it's good to make a distinction between normal social drinking and problem drinking. And local people do make that distinction just as we do in the West. Mostly people do not hold with a disease concept of alcohol. They recognize that drinking alcohol can be addictive. They do have a concept of addiction. But they don't see liquor addiction as a mental illness so much as a just really bad choices that people make consistently. And they hold them responsible for that.